This Week in Radio Tech is supported by Axxia. With over 2,000 consoles on air around the world, Axxia is the leader in IP audio. And now it's the easiest, too, with a built-in pre-configured Ethernet switch in every Axxia power station. On the web at axxiaaudio.com.
And now, our feature presentation, Twirt.
And hopefully, before 4 a.m., we'll be able to fire up all the transmitters, run at full power. Business as usual, Monday morning, nobody is the wiser.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up, Dad?
All your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business,
or in a choice hotel in a distant land,
this is Kirk Harnack.
Uh-oh, somebody let the smoke out. Joining me are Chris Tobin, Chris Tarr, and Tom Ray.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hello and welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, glad to be here with you, and I'm going to be your guide through this menagerie of radio and audio technology, RF technology too. This is the show where we talk about those kind of things, and you know, some folks would say we talk about everything from soup to nuts, and that's good because we have three nuts with us tonight. First of all, in this corner, it's Tom Ray from the Hudson Valley of New York. Hey, Tom.
Hey, how you doing, Kirk? And God help you for having to herd us around. I'm the Vice President of Engineering for Buckley Broadcasting. Work out of WOR Radio in New York City. We have three call letters because we're in New York. Somebody stole one. Next.
Oh, gosh. Bunch of thieves.
All right, the next nut from Manhattan. It's Chris Tobin, the engineer who usually wears a tuxedo. Hi, Chris.
Hello there. How are you this evening, Kirk and Tom?
We're good. Good. Tell us what you do.
I am the broadcast technologist for the CBS Radio Group here in New York City. Three AM stations, three FMs. And we have one heck of a time running around chasing call letters and taking letters from alphabets and doing crazy stuff with other radio stations. Tom's included.
That's right.
You don't have any five call letter stations over there, do you?
Legally, no.
Okay. Maybe you got one from Tom that way. Hey, and let's turn this bus and head out toward the Midwest. From Cucamonga, Wisconsin, it's Chris Tarr. Hi, Chris.
Greetings and salutations, Kirk.
I'll get it right sometime. Tell us what you do, Mr. Tarr.
I am the Director of Engineering for Intercom's radio stations in Madison and Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
And fine stations they are. We had an SBE meeting there one time and was felt royally treated. So I'm sure you're carrying on their fine tradition of royal treatment.
Absolutely.
Do you have any qualifications to participate in the show, Chris Tarr, where we talk about radio engineering?
No, I have none whatsoever. I'm just some lucky stiff that, you know, I happen to fool everybody.
This is why you run that website, Geek Jedi, so you can, you know, when you have a question, you can put it to the audience, right?
That's right. Absolutely. No, I have certifications for the SBE. In fact, I'm going for, I'm going to be taking my test in, I think I'm signed up for the February round of tests for certified senior radio engineer.
So we're getting started. Senior. Why don't we spend a minute and talk about that? Because this is an area that I am so poorly informed about. Here, you know, I was a former, I'm a former SBE chapter chairman, and I was a program chair in the Nashville chapter for a year till they booted me out. And the certification in SBE, this is something that every broadcast engineer ought to at least be aware of and understand the value of it. You know, I guess I got my CBNT, Certified Broadcast Network Technologist rating, but I sure think I could go for more. Chris Tarr, why don't you take a minute and tell us about the certification process and what's available to broadcast engineers?
Well, the certification program came about since the FCC dropped the requirement for licenses, like first-class phones for broadcast engineers. It's been around before that, but it's really taken center stage now that the FCC has dropped that licensing requirement. So what the Society of Broadcast Engineers have done is they get together and they create these exams. And they're essentially proficiency exams, and there's a combination of things that you have to do to get the certification. You have to pass an exam, you have to have a certain amount of experience, and then every 5 years you have to recertify, and you have to do that by participating in learning and continuing education. And there are several levels. There's the Certified Broadcast Technologist, that is the first level, and that you can take right away as long as you're in the broadcast business, and it's a fairly entry level. It's meant for people just getting into the business. There's the CBNT, which you're talking about, which is the Certified Broadcast Network Technologist, and that is for broadcast networking, things like automation systems and networks and broadcast facilities. There's the CBRE, Certified Broadcast Radio Technician. There's the CSRE, Certified Senior Radio Broadcast Engineer. And now there's also DRB, which is for Digital Radio Broadcasting. So I hold certifications, CBRE, Certified Broadcast Radio Engineer, CBNT for the networking, and I also have the DRB, which is the digital radio. And there's, I mean, there are several different levels of certification. There's certifications for AM arrays, for television. Great place to look is on the SBE's website, sbe.org, and it's Society of Broadcast Engineers. But it is really the one way to show potential employers and that sort of thing, even current employers, that you have the skills, and it's just a way to quantify your experience.
And Chris, presently reading the SBE signal that just arrived today, and they've added yet another certification level, the Certified Broadcast Networking Engineer, so CBNE. And that'll be starting in 2011. And it'll be a five-year certification like the senior certification or the professional certification. So it's not just a specialist.
And what's great about these certifications is it's not one of these things where you take it and then that's it and you're done. You do have to go and renew them every 5 years. And the way to do that, there's a combination of different things. For example, writing technical papers counts, attending meetings counts, attending educational seminars count. So you're kind of, in order to get the renewal, you're kind of required to do all these things or take the test again to recertify. So it's kind of a continuing education thing, and it's meant to really keep you involved in the advancement of the industry. So it's a great way to tell whether, and I think on a personal note too, I think it says something about an individual when they go and pursue these things, because there is some time and money and effort involved in doing this. So, it says something to your peers and your employers and potential employers that, you've invested this time on your own education.
Well, as Chris said, the information is available at sbe.org. And if you click on certification, then you can read all about the different certifications that are available to broadcast engineers for experience and through taking of proctored tests. So they're very serious about it. It's a good program. And in fact, we're going to have on a show, we're going to have the executive director of SBE on our program. He agreed when I saw him a few months ago, and he agreed to be on the Torch show. So we'll get him on sometime. But let's move on to the next subject. We were going to talk about something that Chris Tarr had about a BlackBerry. What is it, Chris?
Well, I happen to be surfing one of the sites I go to quite often is crackberry.com. And they happen to have a notification out about a new streaming software. I'm going to pull up the page here real quick. And the software is neat, but the replies about the software are what I really thought was interesting. And essentially, there's a new piece of software called TuneIn Radio, and it's free, and it's for the BlackBerry, and it's basically a way to stream radio stations all over the country. And that's cool enough, but what I thought was really interesting was a lot of these comments, and there are, I think, 62 comments so far on this entry, are people talking about how great it is to have local radio on their BlackBerry. So, oh yeah, Pandora's great, but I'm so excited to get my local radio station on here. I just thought that was really interesting, because a lot of times we're hearing about people talking about how local radio is dead, nobody cares, Pandora's going to kill it. And all of these comments are how happy they are that this software is out because they can listen to their favorite radio stations. I just thought that was really interesting with everything we've heard recently.
Wow, that kind of speaks well. That is an interesting sometimes whether you're reading an article, a newspaper about some political thing, or the forum that you were just reading there on Crackberry, it's interesting the comments. The comments oftentimes can tell you more about the subject than the article did. And not just in terms of the technicalities involved, but in terms of the attitudes of the people who are writing those comments. You can kind of...
Sure,
I know. There's spoilers in every crowd, right? And there's outliers left and right. You can let them go. But to see where most of the comments are coming from, you can learn a lot that way by reading those comments.
And that's what I find interesting is oftentimes, especially, you know, we'll see here in the chat room where you have real technically savvy people, everybody talking, oh, radio's dead. Local radio's dead. Nobody cares. You know, with all this streaming audio and Pandora and all this satellite radio, radio's dead. And you see these, you know, kind of they're slightly ahead of the curve users on CrackBerry. Obviously, they're at a fan site for BlackBerry. But, you know, most of the comments were talking about how great it is to have local radio on their BlackBerries again. And I think that says something.
Do these people have a problem picking up the station, or is it because their BlackBerry doesn't have an FM chip? What do you think is the basis for them wanting local radio on their BlackBerry?
It's, I mean, it sounds like that's what it is. They just like listening to local radio, and you know, let's be honest, iHeartRadio is a great app on the BlackBerry. A lot of people use that, so I think, you know, it's either they're listening, you know, maybe they're listening to their favorite radio station when they're not in the signal area, or you know, when they're walking around or whatever, and it just says something that, you know, the comments are talking about people that are so excited about having the ability to listen to their local radio. So maybe there is something to the FM chip on phones.
In the chat room, this was kind of interesting. Someone says that local radio is really hard to listen to. You know what? Come to think of it, here in the house, I've got a number of AM and FM radios, and I've got a great receiver upstairs in the media room, and I can't tell you the last time that receiver was tuned to an AM or FM station. AM's kind of hopeless unless I want to hear WSM, which is, you know, 4 miles away and 50,000 watts. WLAC here in Nashville is probably 20 miles away from me. And even outside with the car radio, it's tough to pick them up here at my house. So much man-made noise, power line noise and such. But even FM stations, I live very close to some FM transmitters. But if I want to pick up, say, the public station from Murfreesboro, Tennessee, WMOT, and listen to some jazz, not so easy to pick up here at my house. And it should be. What is going on? Why is my impression that 15, 20 years ago, AM and FM radio were so much easier to pick up at my house? Was that the case, or did I just care more about the antenna, or was there less man-made noise? Why is it tougher now than it used to be?
I'll take yes, all of the above.
Yeah, exactly. but I would put emphasis on the man-made noise. There's a lot of man-made noise out there.
Mr. Tobin? Man-made noise is right on the computer or the smartphone that you have near the AM radio.
Yeah,
I have an HD tuner radio in my kitchen. And as long as I don't turn on the microwave oven or try and toast any toast, I'm okay with the reception on the AM. The FM, if I try to do HD FM, I do have to get a little crazy with the T antenna. But yeah, made noise. And then light dimmers. Light dimmers in the house also impact the AM.
What about compact fluorescent bulbs or even the new the LED bulbs? Do they have electronics in them, the LED bulbs?
I have the compact fluorescents, definitely make noise. I do have small little LEDs to replace some halogens, and I don't recall hearing any noise near those, but I'll have to double check that.
Yeah.
Actually, we did an SBE meeting, Kirk, out at Middle Atlantic Products, which was a fascinating tour to see the how they make the racks and such. But Bob Schluter, who runs Middle Atlantic, had a little test set up. He's trying to get a new certification for a type of conduit and a type of wrap with wiring. And he was showing us a compact fluorescent light bulb and what the current distribution looks like and how it's pretty much a sawtooth waveform. What was kind of cool was he pulled out a dimmable compact fluorescent light bulb, and the current was almost a pure sine wave from what you'd expect. It wasn't that sawtooth wave, and it's because of the power supply it uses to dim the bulb. So there was almost no noise coming off that thing, which was fascinating to see.
Wow. Huh. I do wonder what the LED replacement bulbs are going to be doing to as far as noise and you know, putting noise on the power line and putting RF noise out. Obviously, compact fluorescents, this is a problem. Sure, they supposedly meet some kind of specs, but yeah, I don't know if they really do or not. By the time, you know, they've stamped out a couple million of them, are they really meeting the same spec as the sample model that was given for UL approval or FCC approval or Part 15 approval, whatever approval might be necessary. Interesting. I have heard that some LED bulbs put out a whole lot of junk, but I don't know if that's if that's true or not. We ought to check in on that. So with all this man-made noise, oh, by the way, somebody in the chat room said man-made noise. That's Justin Bieber.
I have a teenage daughter. I can absolutely confirm that's true.
but even with the man-made noise, Kirk, you see that on the hand bands, on the 160, 80, and 40-meter hand bands, the noise level has increased dramatically. Here at home, and I haven't found the source of the noise yet, 80 meters is almost useless, and 160 meters, if I have a strong signal, I can talk on it, but the noise level is so doggone high, it's unbelievable.
Do you find that any of your ham equipment, like VHF or UHF ranges, are affected by things? And I ask that because I had, back when I was doing a lot more 2-meter work, there was a local repeater here in Nashville that would always be obliterated at my house because of some wall wart or line lump power supply. If I turned off all the power in the house, they would clear right up. But I'm not sure I ever identified which one that it was. Maybe it's for a router. It may have been for a router, but it was a wall wart power supply that just spewed noise at whatever frequency this 2-meter repeater was. Do you find that, Tom?
No, I haven't found that. I haven't found much noise above the 40-meter band here at home. 20 meters has gotten noisy every so often, but it's very, very rare that I hear any quiet. Anything quiet below 40 meters. The funny thing was, it wasn't this past. It was last New Year's Eve. The 80-meter band was quiet as a mouse. I don't know why. I don't know what changed in the neighborhood. I don't know. I was talking to people on 80 meters I've never been able to talk to before. So,
So back to radio. What about, when they started building so many commercial buildings with metal studs? Was that the beginning of a real problem for receiving AM in commercial buildings?
Yeah, I would agree that'd be the case. But I think it's more man-made noise than anything else. I mean, a lot of buildings, even with the metal rebar, you can still get a decent AM signal if you have a city-grade signal level. But I think it's more of the noise floor just coming up. And also, one thing that you got to remember is most of your digital telephones in the office actually have clock frequencies about at 1.5 megabits and just fall right in the AM band from time to time. The old AT&T System 85s and the Merlins, and I think the Nortel, one of the Nortel systems. So you could actually put an AM radio near the phone, and at certain frequencies on the band, all you hear is square wave noise.
Well, look at over the years, if you look at an office building from 30, 40 years ago, incandescent lights, regular manual key telephones, no computers, they're typewriters. Now you look at a modern office, you've got fluorescent lighting, you've got LED monitors, you've got telephones with CPUs in them, you've got cell phones doing who knows what, transmitting back and forth, several of those in the office. All of those things add to the RF temperature in the room. And all of a sudden, it's just all these different things generating noise.
Wow. And is this something a broadcaster should have seen coming? And even if so, what could we do about it? Because all the things that you just mentioned, Chris, represent improvements, valid improvements in technologies. They're not improvements in radio technology, but they're improvements in lighting efficiency and, of course, computers, supposedly improvements in productivity there. Is this the natural progression of things? Where do we go from here? How do we circumvent this?
I think it's the natural progression. And unfortunately, there's really, you can't turn back the clock and put the genie back in the bottle. But I mean, broadcasters are starting to do creative things. For example, fairly soon I'll be putting our AM station on an HD sub channel. A lot of large markets are doing that now. You've got, some AMs doing translators, and you've got a lot of stations now streaming their audio. It's great for AM where you're having these signal issues in a building. Aside from that, what else can you do? It is what it is. I hate that saying, but in this case, it's true. Genie's out of the bottle. So we as broadcasters and engineers have to come up with some creative ways to get our content to these people through these, all these different obstacles.
Do you think we're going to get onto the Empire State Building question shortly. I know we keep coming back to this question, though, and the interference is a good reason to get back to it, of ending up having a model where our content as broadcasters, instead of being based entirely on terrestrial distribution through the AM and the FM bands, is instead based on a whole streaming model, using wired and wireless technologies, and of course a whole slew of wireless technologies, from Wi-Fi to WiMAX to LTE, all the 4G technologies, and who knows what else may come along down the pike. Is that where we're going? And if so, of course, do broadcasters have a lot to fear, or are they already king of content in some cases? In other cases, probably obviously not.
We're doing it now. I mean, we focus as much on internet streaming and HD technology and things like that than we are with the analog transmitters. We all have apps, and we all have, if you're a radio station and you're not doing streaming and you're not looking ahead to those technologies with iPhones and iPads and mobile devices, you're quickly getting buried. So if you're not, you should. But I think most companies have already figured that out and realized that, the analog radio is just one method of distribution out of many.
The same thing that's happened to broadcasters, though, in the AM band around 1 megahertz and the FM band around 100 megahertz, will the same thing interference-wise, man-made interference, that's happened to those, what will that affect Wi-Fi and 3G and 4G technologies in years to come?
Oh, that's already happening in a lot of areas, Kirk. Especially in a market like New York City. I don't know if it's like with the 3G and 4G. I don't know if it's necessarily the noise. Noise floor, but it's definitely a bandwidth issue when a lot of people pull out their cell phones and start using a lot of data. You can see the bandwidth just go right down. For example, in lower Manhattan where we are, you can open up your computer and say, okay, find me a wireless access point. From my office, I can see 35. And there are only 10 channels. So how do you get around it? Yeah. I mean, there's no way around it. So
I still think, another thing that we forget is that for at least the near future, radio is still going to rule the car. And then you just can't get around it. We're still, you don't have building penetration issues. It works well. It's non-distracting. It's easy to use. It's, there's no bandwidth problems, great coverage. So I still think, as offices and people at home turn more and more to internet to get their content, and generally, that means a lot of times your local radio station. I still think in the near term, we're still going to rule the mobile, the cars and vehicles.
Well, I hope you're right. And as we move on forward, I got to believe in the next year or two, we're going to find 4G receivers in cars, either as an option or something that you could. Of course, you could take a MiFi right now and slap it on your dashboard and drive around with some pretty good speeds in metropolitan areas.
And if you're willing to pay, it'll work. We go back to that. You're right. There's going to be, but you're going to be paying some money to do it, and you're going to have bandwidth caps, and you're going to have all these different things. So, I think until we know that this 4G is going to come out and it's going to be uncapped and it's going to be readily available, it's something to think about. But it's not nearly as worrisome as some people think it should be.
Wow. Well, hey, we're going to get to the Empire State Building because that's going to take up the rest of our show. It's really interesting. So, Burke, get ready with the pictures as Chris Tobin calls out for them. We're going to talk about a problem at the Empire State Building, and it doesn't have to do with a giant gorilla. First, I want to tell you about our new sponsor, and that is Axia Audio. Now, I need to let you know that I'm an employee of Telos Omnia and Axia. So these guys, I work for them. They sign my paycheck. But they're also a sponsor of the Twerk podcast, and I thank them for that very, very much. And, I guess really I'm pretty well qualified to tell you something about Axia, to impart to you some of the features and benefits of an Axia IP audio system. So let me just start out by telling you that I think Axia IP audio is a great technology. It indeed is flexible. It is powerful in that you can do so much with it. It's really cost effective, especially when you consider the reduced cabling and the reduced labor involved in getting a studio set up and maintaining it. But some people told us, some customers told us, and in fact, my co-hosts Chris Tobin and Tom Ray could have told us this, that it's a little bit hard to figure the net to configure the network switch that Axia uses. Typically, we use Cisco switches. Some people use HP switches, but there's some configuration involved. So Axia made it
easy. Axia has put a custom-built, pre-configured IP audio Ethernet switch inside the new PowerStation console system. There's no switch configuration at all. It's ready to go right out of the box. You turn on the power, you plug in your sources, your CD players, your satellite receivers, your automation systems, and you name those things in your browser, bam, you're ready to go. No switch configuration. There's over 2,000 Axia consoles on the air or in production rooms right now. Axia, definitely the leader in IP audio, and now the easiest too, because the switch is built right in. Hey, Chris,
you know, Kirk?
Yeah, go ahead, Tom.
I think that's a great idea because, you know, when we set up the system at WOR and we were the first large-scale integration of Axia, it took quite a while to set up the network switches on that. And but boy, I tell you, we've had the system online for 5 years now, and the flexibility, you can't beat it. And we help Chris out at least once a year for the 9/11 memorial services, you know, because our offices overlook the overlook Ground Zero. And boy, whatever Chris wants, all he has to do is say, hey, look, can you send this to this ISDN? Can you send this someplace else? We just hop on a computer terminal and go bang, 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 done. Hey, Chris, are you happy? Yeah, I'm happy. So, you know, we love it. We think it's it's pretty much the greatest thing since sliced bread, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. Putting everything in one box makes total sense. When I install the Axia system that I've used, having separate boxes and programming switches, yes, there's a bit of a learning curve. But putting it in one box, being able to plug it in and run with it, definitely has its benefits. And the robustness of what you had in separate pieces to put in one chassis, you can't beat it. And Tom's right. When I would visit his stations to do the broadcast, and when I had many outside broadcasts of our own, being able to access the Axia system remotely over IP was a easiest thing you could ever think of. And now, one box, one solution, it makes it even that much better. I would agree.
And even though it's not a bad idea to get some network training for your career as a broadcast engineer, you don't need it with the new Axia PowerStation console system. So we thank Axia very much for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. You can check out Axia for yourself, including white papers and lots of information on how IP audio works and can work for you. The web address is axiaaudio.com. axiaaudio.com. And on the website, you can sign up to receive e-news from Telos Omnia Axia and be updated about once a month on things that are happening in the IP audio world and the world of telephony and audio processing from Telos, Omnia, and Axia. Thanks again for their sponsorship of This Week in Radio Tech.
So we're back and talking about this problem at the Empire State Building, and I didn't hear anything about this. So, Mr. Tobin, what do you know?
Well, you're not supposed to hear about these things. It's, you know, inside baseball. It's just simple stuff, nothing bad. The Empire State Building the other night, Monday night, experienced the building itself didn't experience the problem. The master antenna system for the New York City broadcasters experienced a problem. We're not sure what exactly caused the failure, but the antenna system is a two-bay panel antenna system designed by ERI. It's up on the mooring mast. Let's see if you've ever seen a picture of the Empire State Building. The very top has the mast and all these little things sticking off it. It's about just at the base. So the building comes up, and then they have a little part of the tower. It's right there. It's two panel antenna systems. It makes for an omnidirectional signal. Very, very nice. Works very well. It's about 17 years old. Well, Monday night, one of the two transmission lines that feed the upper and lower bays of this antenna system fatigued, collapsed, and about 15,000 watts of RF just decided to short into a dead hole in the coax, and flamed out. Took the radio stations off the air, only momentarily. All of the broadcasters on the Empire State Building have automatic failover to their backup sites, and within a few seconds, everybody was back on the air from their alternate sites. But we did have a scramble, and many of us were up at the Empire State Building Monday night until the wee hours of the morning, inspecting what took place and pulling out the parts, and it was a mess. But it was fun. And that picture there is the inside of what is a transmission line, inch and 5/8, I believe, is that line. That's burned. It's normally a silver bullet. It's a spleen or a spline type of bullet. So it has small little slits in it. As you can see, the RF burned it like a torch. That's the photo on the far right, upper right-hand side. The photo on the left side, upper left, is a section of that same transmission line where the PVC, a plastic coating on the coax, which is copper, corrugated copper, melted away. It's approximately 4 to 5 feet in length. At the very left of that image, which you won't see in that picture, are two small holes about the size of a pen cap top that the RF came out of, along with the nitrogen, which is used to pressurize the line. And we do that so that the inner conductor on the right-hand picture, which is normally not burnt, and the outer conductor, which is the corrugated shell, don't arc or flash over. So the nitrogen creates an insulator, sort of like air does, but nitrogen is more of an insulator for what we're doing for FM transmission. And the leak caused the nitrogen pressure to drop, which therefore means the RF power, which was around 15,000 watts, I believe. Not exactly sure the exact number, but to flame out and destroy the coax. In doing so, that termination, what you're seeing right now, oops, with the rope, that is a power divider. So you have the power coming up from the combiner room, where all 16 radio stations combine their outputs of their transmitters. They get combined together, fed up transmission lines to a power divider, which then splits the power to the various bays of the antenna system. That also was damaged. So the section of transmission line, about 25 feet, was removed Monday night. Power divider was removed and driven down to the manufacturer, ERI, for repair and forensics work to find out what exactly took place. So it looks like fatigue. It's a 17-year-old system operating 24/7, exposed to the elements atop of the city's tallest building. So at about 1,020 feet is where this sits. You could just imagine the elements it's exposed to and the environment. So, you know, the weather takes its toll. So that's my guess. It's just my opinion. We won't know more until probably next week. So it was a mad scramble for everybody to get onto their alternate sites. It was a good test to find out how well we manage our backup systems and what works and doesn't work. And I'm happy to report that we did very well. And so did the Clear Channel stations, Citadel, and the public stations, and Emmis as well. So everybody was in good shape.
So what's the upshot now for people who are using this site? You mentioned some people are on their backup sites. Which stations, if any, are still on the Empire State Building site, and what kind of power are they able to run?
Well, everybody, as far as I know, and again, it's at the discretion of the broadcasters, but everyone has the ability to operate. There's two bays. So the lower bay is what was, not the bay itself, but the feed line to the lower bay was damaged. We have the ability using U-links, which are very large physical patch panels, the patch points in the shape of a U, about 6 inches in diameter, and they can be pulled out of a patch panel, which then we can direct the power to which bay we want to use, upper or lower, or both, depending on how we use the power divider. Since the power divider was damaged, we bypassed that. So the output of the combiner system is now feeding the upper bay, so everybody is operating at about 60% power, just to avoid any concerns. We always operate with about, you know, like a 30-40% safety margin, because you just don't know what to expect. So that leaves us room for any issues that may occur. Now, we're high up on the building. The difference in pattern, the difference in coverage is minimal. You know, the old saying is it's like 1 dB per mile for a coverage. So if you're not running the two bays, so we're probably down maybe, you know, 2 dB in the RF level, if you will. Again, rough numbers, just my wild, crazy guess. You know, you're probably talking 3 miles taken off of your fringe signal. At that point, you're already butting up against your co-channel, so you won't notice it. Alternate sites for everybody operate somewhat away from the center of Manhattan, so your pattern may be different depending on what you decided to go with. But again, it's full power. We're all Class B stations here in the city. Everybody's fully functional. PPMs are encoding, and everything is flowing like it should. I drove around the city, the suburbs, listening to my FM stations, and you'd be very hard-pressed to know they were operating at a diminished power. Yeah, we didn't hit that 3 dB point, so we're in good shape. We're, you know, it's working out well.
Wow. So what's the procedure to fix that mess? What is there custom work that a company has to build up to replace what's flamed out?
Well, the work that's there's the power divider. The work that's being done is being done by ERI. They're the manufacturer of the antenna system. As I pointed out, it's a 17-year-old system or 18-year-old. It is a one of a kind. It's not like as if we have many Empire State Building systems around the country. So they're repairing it. Hopefully the damage that was caused by the flame out from the RF was not too severe and they can't, you know, they run into a problem. But last word was everything is moving according to plan. So they repair it. There are two gentlemen from a company who manage the antenna system for us, a company called DSIRF, and they have driven this part down to Indiana, to ERI, and they'll be driving it back because it's a one-of-a-kind. The idea was not to risk air freight or some other means of transportation outside of the broadcaster. So they drove it down. It's there today. It'll be coming back tomorrow evening. And then the plan would be over the weekend, we'll shut down the master antenna after midnight. We only have a small window to work with because the observation deck at the Empire State Building is open until 2 a.m. So when we do these emergency shutdowns, we do request that they shut down early. So you can imagine that creates a little trouble. So
is that in case somebody drops a wrench?
No. Because what we do is we operate on a backup antenna system, the original master antenna system.
What's that thing called? It's got a name.
Alford. A-L-F-O-R-D.
The Alford antenna, yes. Okay.
Back in the 1960s. It's, if you can picture, take a styrofoam cup, put it upside down, and around the rim at the very top, take the shape of little T's, okay, and put them at an angle. You know, like a 45-degree angle encompassing the entire cup. And in this case, up there, I think it's 17 or 20 elements. Those at a 45-degree angle create what was known at the time as an elliptical signal. And that was the master antenna system. There were two bays. There were two sets of T's, upper and lower, and they were separated by about five or six feet, which, you know, roughly the wavelength of FM. And that was the original one of all. There were only two of its kind at the time back in 1960s. I think Philadelphia was the other one, and then here at the Empire State Building. And that Alford antenna system functioned up until 1987? I'm trying to remember now. Something like that. And then the new system went online. So that's what we use as a backup. We use the broadband input. Everybody gets put into that. However, because of the RFR laws and rules of the day, the observation deck, for safety reasons, you don't want to have it running just to make sure there's no...
There's
no issue. It's just, why take a chance? So, we ask to shut down an hour early. They do their thing. Everybody's happy. You know, we don't do this every day, so it's not an encumbering operation for the building, for the broadcasters. It's just, it's an emergency. We do it. We get it done. That also includes the television stations have to shut down and move to their alternate sites while we're up there working.
Ah, okay. So, for the safety of the workers, sure. Hey, I got a question. You referred earlier to an upper and a lower bay for the FMs at the on the Empire State Building up near the top. Can you help us understand what these bays look like? And isn't there actually more than one bay at each level? When you say two bays, there's an upper bay and a lower bay, but each bay consists of several parts around the outside of the tower, doesn't it?
Yes, depending on the antenna system you go with. So in the case of the Empire State Building, it's a panel antenna. Panel antennas, if you could imagine a screen, take the square panel out of a screen door and then mount in the center of that, protruding from a perpendicular, say, like a cross-type metal structure.
Yeah.
That would be the antenna. Okay, so that's a panel antenna. Now, if you put that panel antenna on a pole, then you should get an omnidirectional signal. Now, you take that panel antenna design, take a second one on that same pole vertically, one above the other, separated by approximately a half a wavelength to reduce the amount of signal going to the ground, again, for RFR. You now have what's called a single bay and then a second bay. That's two bay antenna. So each antenna element is a bay. Now, in the case of the Empire State Building, because the building structure is larger than a tower mass, which is typically 2 or 3 feet in diameter, you now take several of these panels. In the case of the Empire State Building, I believe it's four on each bay. So you have a north, south, east, and west, upper, half wavelength below that, north, south, east, and west. And now you have a two-bay panel antenna system. And then those two bays get fed power from the combiner room into a power divider, which then splits it equally to upper and lower to create the pattern and the power required by FCC law, a rule. Does that help to paint a picture?
Yeah, it sure does. And you know what? You may remember a terrific picture from the guys at ERI looking down from
Tom
higher
Sullivan.
Up. Yes, and I'm going to send this link over to Burke. Burke, you have got to show this link. It is absolutely amazing. There are plenty of pictures on the web. That's an old antenna. There are plenty of pictures on the web of the Alfred antenna, and there are pictures of what Burke just showed a moment ago. But, Burke, I just sent you a new link, and this picture is just, it'll make your heart stop if you imagine yourself being where the photographer was at the time this picture was taken. It's absolutely amazing. Don't worry, the people who are in the picture are all tied to the tower. There's no safety issues going on there. And so Burke ought to have that up here pretty shortly.
One of my favorite pictures. I get vertigo just looking at it.
Oh, man.
And I missed your episode where you guys showed that video of the tower climber a few weeks back. I used to climb towers. I don't climb them anymore, but I used to climb towers. And this stuff didn't scare me. But I'll tell you, this picture that Burke is about to show, this picture just takes your breath away. I think this picture appeared in the New York Times.
It's the one I think it was, Kirk, I think it also appeared in National Geographic.
Yeah, it did. Really? It's been everywhere.
Yep.
I think it was a documentary. It was part of a documentary, I believe.
Let's see. Burke, did I not get that to you? I thought I did in the private chat. It's a Picasso web, or somebody's got it stored on Picasso web. We can come back to that. By the way, I'm going to post pictures. There we go. Can you either zoom that up or kill the preview of it and just show the actual photo from the Picasa website? The resolution was a lot better without looking at the preview. I'd knock the preview off my own view of it too. We're going to show these pictures on the website. We'll have links to them in the show notes, so you can go back and look at some of the things that Chris Tobin's been telling us about. We also have some pictures. I believe, Chris, I've got some pictures of the combiner room, which is the most incredible plumbing project you've ever seen. Signals, heavy duty, 6,000, 8,000, 10,000 watts of RF coming from transmitter rooms on several floors all around the top of the Empire State Building. It's all piped to one room where it's combined properly so that all these, none of the transmitters is aware of the presence of any of the other transmitters, if you will. And that's the job of a combiner. You can't just take the output of two transmitters and put them on a Y cable and, connect them together and expect that to work, because an active transmitter will be looking into another active transmitter, and these power levels here are pretty high, so you can't just use a circulator to keep them separated from each other. So you have to use these combiners, and so when you're using a combiner, and they're different designs of combiners, but in this case they're just great big drums that are tuned inside to the correct physical size with ports going in and out of them. And they make it so that each station's transmitter is pretty much unaware of the presence of the other transmitters, yet they all combine their power together to go out to the antenna, in this case to the two-bay stacked antenna. So we have no luck on the picture, or did I miss it?
I don't know.
Well, Might not be luck.
When he finds it, if he does find it, that picture shows Tom Silliman, the son of the founder, the person who brought ERI back to its successful days. I think it was Ron, or is it Robert Silliman was the dad. In any case, that's Tom and one of his other guys. And if you look, when you do see it on the website, if we don't get it up from Burke, the structure I told you about, perpendicular from the screen door effect, is the antenna, the radiating element. And surrounding them from behind is the open mesh, which creates the panel, which helps for the directivity, creating a pattern. And that picture was taken above them on the mast at a height of 1,385 feet above ground level.
Holy cow! Oh, man. Right.
So you can imagine that if you had to run at 60% power, you'd still get a signal out to the masses.
I found a second version of that picture, and I sent that link to Burke as well. It turns out the Picasa website had a warning on it that they were doing some maintenance, so maybe that's why it wasn't up. But Burke, I sent you another link to that same picture.
Okay, if you have a problem, I have one you can do too.
Okay, I wanted to show it on the live stream. Oh, and here's yet another one. There are a number of links to this around the net. Not all of them are of good a quality. That I'd like to see. All right. Well, I'll tell you what. If we don't get it on, we'll definitely put it in the show notes. It's a picture worth seeing. You're going to go when you see it. So what's the procedure to fix this thing? People, men, women, tower climbers have to get up and get outside
we're such a modern group of broadcasters. We've got these nanobots that we're going to put together, and they're going to climb the tower. No, I'm only kidding. Sorry, reading two of my Dan Coons books. Well, the procedure will be to there'll be a crew of probably a half a dozen men who will arrive at the building sometime over the weekend, and shortly after 1 a.m., we load up the elevators, the observation deck elevators, bring up the equipment, the power combiner. The power divider, that is, I believe, is it 5 feet tall by 3 feet wide? It's pretty big, pretty heavy, too. So that'll be brought up to the 103rd floor observation deck hatch, and then they'll hoist it up out of the hatch, I believe, out of the building up to the bottom of the mast. I haven't been up there in a while, so I'll have to see if I can get up there this weekend and check it out. Yes, when you're up at the very top in the small catwalk about 2 feet wide, there's about 10 feet of building, and the rest is just open sky. It's really fun. You could just imagine what it was like for the gorilla guy. But that's what we'll do. They'll bring the stuff up. They'll pull apart the transmission lines that are up there now, reinsert the equipment, reconnect it, and then we'll start doing measurements with network analyzers, TDRs, time domain reflectometers, to verify that everything is working, all the bullets are properly secured. They'll measure the pressure in the line and make sure the line is pressurized to preserve the insulation that's required, or the insulator characteristics of nitrogen and the coax. And hopefully by Sunday morning, Monday morning before 4 a.m., we'll be able to fire up all the transmitters, run at full power, measure, monitor, and see how things run for about 2 or 3 hours. And then business as usual, Monday morning, nobody is the wiser. That's pretty much it in a nutshell.
I just sent Burke a link over here. That picture is of Silliman on the antenna element is actually quite amazing. But what's even more amazing is seeing the picture of him changing the light bulb on top.
The light bulb. The light bulb.
Yeah, it's like, oh my God.
Actually, Burke, I just sent you an email, the file that we were talking about. So if you need to put it up that way, you should be able to get that done. Oh, Tom, I just opened your link for the lamp. Oh, man.
Yeah, isn't that incredible?
This is going on the show notes as well. So, oh, my gosh. That's amazing. Oh, no, I'm glad that's...
These tower climbers, I mean, they're a breed unto themselves. I don't even like the roof of my house.
Okay, here's the picture we've been yapping about here for so long. That's looking down into New York City, folks. And so you can see the street level way down below there. You can see the observation deck where the people are, observing the rest of the city, maybe even unaware of the presence of Tom Silliman and his helper there on the panel antenna. And so, Chris Tobin, this is the panel antenna. They're on the upper one, are they not?
It looks like the upper bay. Yes, the upper bay.
And we say bay, there's actually four of these things around four different sides of that top of the tower.
Right.
Okay.
So yeah, if you put that back up, Burke, I could just explain what I was talking about with the screen mesh, if that helps anybody. If you're looking at the picture, you see Tom is the gentleman in the center with the hood partially behind him with the little fur. What's in front of the two gentlemen is the actual radiating element that I spoke about that protrudes from the fence, the screen door effect. And that's that mesh that you see on both left and right-hand sides looking down. And that mesh interacts with the antenna, the radiator. And there's four of those, and they're upper and lower. And right now, they're probably replacing the heating element. There's a de-icer in those to prevent ice from building up, as you can imagine, at that height. So that's the electrical work they were doing, I believe, on that particular bay, that particular element as well. Yeah, but that's on a clear day. Sun coming in. Looks like the sun's coming in from the east, and a nice, bright, early morning start. And that's off and running. It's quite a view.
Chris, earlier you mentioned about nitrogen, and I get asked this question a lot because we have nitrogen bottles delivered out to transmitter sites, or there's even products that extract nitrogen from the air. There's so much of it, you wouldn't think it'd be that hard a thing, but extract nitrogen from the air. Why is it exactly that we put nitrogen into a transmission line. You said that it improves the dielectric properties. It helps keep it from arcing over. Some people use dry air that's been run through a drying process, so there's no moisture in it. What's the reason for that?
You can use two types of dielectric. As we know, air is a dielectric. If it's void of moisture, it's even more of a dielectric. The trick is, depending on the power level, at certain power levels, dry air just won't do it for you, where nitrogen and inert gas is needed. It's used to prevent many things. One, by maintaining a positive pressure in the transmission line, you prevent contaminants from getting in should the line get breached. It also prevents moisture getting in, which means you have less chance or no chance of corrosion taking place inside the transmission line, which also will cause problems. Corrosion will cause resistance, high reflected power, and transmission signals will be very poor in reception for the listener. It also, the difference between nitrogen and air, many things, again, just the power levels you can operate with. If you do nitrogen, as Kirk pointed out, you have a tank. You have a finite source of the nitrogen. What do you do in the event that there's a leak? Well, that tank is going to expire pretty fast unless you have several tanks set up in there's a name for this, the device. We have multiple tanks. I'm sorry?
Would it be a manifold?
Manifold, thank you. Didn't come to mind. You have a manifold with several tanks and various gauge valves that when pressure drops in one, the next one opens. You can do that to protect yourself. Or you do the compressed air where it's a continuous pump running air from the room it's in through several filters which use various types of crystal or rock or like carbon material to extract the moisture from the air, and the pump continues to run to maintain pressure. You're only talking typically like 3 or 4 pounds of pressure, depending on the length of the cable run, maybe sometimes 5. And that's what you need to keep the line pressurized. The dielectric is the same as insulation on your wire and your lamp in your house. Without that rubber or plastic coating between the wires, you have a lot of sparks. Without that dielectric air, foam, or nitrogen, you'd have a lot of sparks once you reach that point where the two conductors say to each other, hey, I see you together. We're mutually conductive. Let's have a fun time and spark. That's basically how it works out. So that's the reason for nitrogen or dry compressed air. How's that? Does that help?
Yeah, and what I wanted to point out is what happens to a lot of station engineers who aren't watching out, aren't being careful, or in some cases aren't given the budget to buy some more nitrogen. Let's imagine that you've got this length of coax. This is some pretty heavy duty coax, maybe 1 5/8 diameter, 2 1/4, 3 and you know the 3-inch diameter, the 5-6, you know, in whatever size it is. Most people are familiar with coaxial cable that uses a foam dielectric, like you'd have with RG8 type of coax, or maybe 1/2 inch, or even 7/8 inch type of coax, where you've got a foam that's in there, and that's reasonably impervious to water. Even if there's a little nick or something in the outer conductor of the coax, water's not so willing to get into that because there's foam there, and the foam is cellular. So the water may get into a cell or two of the foam, but it's not going to spread any farther than that. But foam dielectric is not necessarily what you want for some really big coax. It's going to handle a whole lot of power, either from one very powerful station or a combination of stations. So we tend to use a coaxial cable or feed line that's, you know, straight hard line that has this just open space between the inner conductor and the outer conductor. Well, what happens at what can happen is if you've got this length of coax, let's imagine some black jacketed 3 1/8 inch coax that's, you know, going up a 500-foot tower that's carrying power to the FM antenna of some radio station. During the day, what happens is the sunlight, you know, shines upon this black coax and heats it up. And the air inside of it gets warmer, and it, of course, expands. Well, it's looking for a place to get out. And if there's just a tiny pinhole or an O-ring seal that's not perfect anywhere in the system, or something's loose, or an O-ring was not seated properly when something was put together, like in a typical, you know, 10-bay FM antenna that a station might use, you could easily have 30 connections or 40 connections that have O-rings in them. Well, if one of those wasn't done exactly right, then you're going to have a little place where air can get out. Well, the sun goes down, night falls, everything cools off, including the air inside the coax, and now all of a sudden there's a little bit of a vacuum in there. And what does it want to do? It wants to draw air into the coax from the outside, because now the outside air has a higher pressure than the inside, than the air inside the coax. And so this is it. By the way, all this I'm describing is if you don't pressurize the coax with some inert gas. So air can come in from the outside. And what is this air laden with? Moisture. So this outside air comes into the coax just a little bit all through the night, and we get moisture-laden air inside the coax. Well, the next day, this happens all over again. And the warm air leaves a little pinhole in the coax and goes outside, but the moisture, a lot of it stays behind. So over time, you get cycle after cycle after cycle of this happening, and you end up building up moisture, water actually, usually at the bottom of the coax, where it makes a loop and goes, you know, from the vertical tower structure, it goes horizontal and on into the building. So water builds up there, and enough water builds up, and bam, it flashes over because of the RF power that's there, and you get boiling water and a transmitter tripping off, hopefully, and or some burned up coax. And my goodness, there have been many times when the only remedial action was to take an electric drill, turn the transmitter off first, take an electric drill and drill a little hole in the bottom of the coax at the very lowest point, and just watch the water come out like you know what on a you know what. It's like really comes out under a lot of pressure. Once that water's out, now you've got a coax with a real hole in it, and you can patch that up as best you can, and then put some dry nitrogen onto that. So there you go.
That
that's the reason
if we
pressurize the coax even just a little tiny bit, then we have a positive pressure in there, and the outside air will never ever get into it as long as we maintain a little bit of positive pressure in there. Okay, that's my lecture speech for this session.
And Burke has that picture ready of the top light.
Oh, there you go.
Cool. That's at about 1435 feet. Is that the very top of the building, Chris?
I think 1345 is the very top. Yes.
Which direction are we looking there,
those
Tom?
Beacons, that obstruction beacon is about what 5 feet in height, Tom? Right? Is that
the obstruction beacons are about three and a half feet.
Because
I've got one in the garage.
I got one here in my house too.
Yeah, aren't they great?
I promise I'm going to hook it up sometime.
That looks like towards the southeast. It looks like the East River on the other side, and that looks like the lower end of Manhattan down there.
That's definitely lower end. Yes, it is. There's the Metropolitan Life Building down behind Tom. Facing south. That's pointing southeast.
If we could see it, we would see the what's the famous bridge? I can't think of right now.
Brooklyn Bridge.
The Brooklyn Bridge. Yes, the Brooklyn Bridge would be toward the end of the island there.
Would you like to buy it? I have it for sale. I mean, you send me a check, Kirk. I'll be happy to. You know, I'll give you the deed.
Hey, we've been talking about this problem at Empire State. I do want to wrap that up in just a minute, but let's check in with Chris Tarr. Chris, are you still awake?
Oh yeah, I'm still here.
You have surely, with the FM stations that you take care of, you've also had some kind of a burnout where there's been damage like this. What were the circumstances behind that?
I'll tell you what, I don't have nothing as fancy as you guys out there in New York City. I haven't had anything burn out. I have, however, inherited a line where we had a problem with water. You know, we'd have a real high reflected power in the line, and you know, it wasn't pressurized for a long time. And so I knew there was stuff in there. We did exactly what you're talking about. I drilled a hole right in the bottom where the coax is coming into the building, and sure enough, nice warm water just came rushing out of there. And then, of course, then you patch it up and you charge it up. But I have seen the aftermath of a great story. Was a guy who installed this brand new coax switch with fail safes in him, and he was going to show his assistant how great this fail safe worked on his on the coax switch. Left the transmitter on, hit the coax switch, assuming that the fail safe was going to work, and shut the transmitter off, and it didn't, and it burned up the switch. So, you know, there are situations like that where that happens. But, you know, I do know, I have heard stories of transmission line actually arcing over on the tower and burning up as the, you know, as the jacket burns, the flames go up the tower and stuff comes flying off, that sort of thing. So it is, you know, for people who aren't real familiar with it, if you're using air charge line, which at most power levels above a kilowatt, you probably should. You know, we do have sensors hooked up, pressure sensors and gauges and things, so that we know whether or not those lines are pressurized. And, you know, sometimes you can go fairly, you know, for a little bit with an uncharged line if there's a failure. But, you know, you really have to be careful with that, especially if you're running towards the limit of the capacity of that line. You know, for example, if you're trying to run, you know, 15 kilowatts into an inch and 5/8 line, you don't have any wiggle room there. But, you know, if it's a couple of kilowatts in a 3-inch line, the chances of that arcing over are pretty slim. So, you know, a lot of it has to do with the power handling of the line and things like that.
Sounds good. Hey, you know what? We need to wrap the show up, but I want to ask Chris Tobin about the repair procedure now. We talked a little bit about that, but when do you expect this to happen? And when do you expect to be back at full power? Just within a few days?
Yes, within a few days. If all goes according to plan, the work is done on the repairs to the power divider as we speak. It's taking place at ERI, at their factory. The plan would be to implement the repairs over Sunday morning, you know, Saturday night, Sunday morning, and then Sunday night, Monday morning again, with the hopes of being at full power, full operations from the Empire State Building on Monday after 5 a.m., or actually 4:30 a.m. So that's the plan. Now, again, once you get back up on the top of the building Saturday night, we may find something else is wrong and be like, whoa, okay, another set of problems. Again, 17-year-old system running 16 radio stations, power combined. At that point, can be anywhere, I think, around 120,000 watts of RF. So a lot of voltage going through those cables and components. So who's to say that maybe we don't find something else? But hopefully not.
So any final thoughts as to the cause of that? If it's a hole the size that you were showing there, it almost looks like it was a lightning strike.
It could have been. My guess, and I talked to a guy who worked at Cellwave, building antennas, doing design work on transmission lines and doing all that wonderful physics and mathematics, and I showed him the pictures. He immediately said, "Ah, that looks like fatigue." He goes, "That's just probably wear and tear." I said, "Really?" He goes, "Oh, yeah. Yeah, over time, the copper, you know, breaks down. All it takes is a small pinhole at that power level. It'll flame out and take out the rest of the transmission line." He said it in a very matter-of-fact way. So I sort of had to take him seriously, thinking, well, he does this for a living. He's been doing it for 20 years. He's probably seen all types of, you know, failures. He did a lot of military work, so who knows what he's seen there, the power levels they run. And he just looked at it and was like, "Oh, yeah." I said, it wasn't like lightning? He goes, "Eh, it could be, but usually lightning takes out other things around it." And and those pictures don't show it. There are another set of pictures up there, and you don't see any other damage around the cable harnesses, you know, the metal plating, the girder work, the truss work. Nothing else appears damaged. So, you know, it's hard to say. But I think the guys at ERI, the antenna manufacturer, they've seen a lot of this stuff. They know what to look for. So when they take apart the power divider tonight, as they have been, I'm sure they'll look at it and go, "Oh, yeah, here's what took place. Here's why and how we know it." And we'll know more next week. The broadcasters will get a full report. And then, you know, we'll just move on and continue making money, hopefully.
Wow. Wow. And you know, it's interesting that they think it wasn't associated with a catastrophic event, like somebody hitting it with a wrench or a lightning strike. But I can see how their theory could be right. And they do see that every day.
Yeah, amazing. I don't think it was somebody with a wrench, because when there's work done up on the tower structure, when there's other work being done, there are people up there who just monitor the work to avoid bumping into other stuff. It is, you know, they're very tight quarters. Yeah. I will say that it's not something you can just freely run around with a tool belt on your hip and just do what you want. So people take great caution when they traverse the mooring mast and go up and down and do what they have to do.
There you go. And that's called the mooring mast. I was looking for the word, and that's it. It's the mooring mast. Because
that's part of the mooring mast is the section, I'm told, that's below the mast itself. Yeah. There's a couple of pieces to that upper structure. It's very, very crowded up there. Lots of RF. Trust me. Lots of RF.
And originally, Kirk, I think they were going to moor dirigibles to the Empire State Building back in the 1930s. That's why it's called the mooring mast.
Actually, I think they were going to put blimps up there.
Yeah, and I think they did a couple of them, and they had a problem with the winds coming up from the coming up the building, and they couldn't keep everything steady, so they kind of abandoned that idea.
Were they going to have people climb off the end of the dirigible onto the mast and then down into?
Yep.
Yes.
Oh.
There are up in the base of the mast. If I could find a picture, I don't have it now. But the base of the mast, you'll see what look like little portholes And those are the doors, or part of the original doors that would have been what you'd use to get back into the building. It'd come down a ramp. There was a picture. One of the guys who worked the Empire State Building for some 30 plus years had a picture of what it would be like to come off a dirigible or blimp down this, like a rope ladder type ramp to the top of the building, and you'd climb into the hole, into the porthole, and into the building itself. And I just looked at that. I was like, I've been up there with a climbing belt, and it's difficult just by yourself. I can just imagine a blimp trying to maintain a steady position. There you go.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine? Come on, Grandpa. Come on, Dad. You can do it. Come on.
Yeah, exactly.
We've been across the Atlantic. I know we're back from France now. You can do it. Just walk down the gangplank and hold on tight. And at the whole time, seeing the same scene that we saw with Tom Silliman in that picture looking straight down.
Right. Oh, it's just, you got to give him credit for the time. You know, that was definitely something you probably wouldn't do today. If that circumstances exist and dirigibles were the thing of the day, we probably would be like, what are you, crazy? No. With all luck, there's too many safety rules. We'd never even get off the ground with it. It would just be like on the drawing board. That's it.
Yeah.
That was back in the day when men were men.
Hey, guys, we're going to wrap it up here with a couple of picks of the week. And I was remiss in alerting you to that again this week. So I'm going to give you my pick of the week. And while I'm talking slowly, you can come up with your own picks of the week. My pick of the week is a tool that that I found very helpful in doing the more modern broadcast engineering work. And so many of the things that we want to control around a radio station, we can do remotely if we're familiar with the concept of port forwarding. Now, if you're a regular listener to the show, if you're a regular viewer and listener of the Twit Network, you probably know exactly what port forwarding is. If you haven't yet understood the nuances or the basics of port forwarding, this is something that you need to do. And there's a website that will help you understand that. It's portforward.com, P-O-R-T-F-O-R-W-A-R-D, portforward.com. And there they list, first of all, they tell you what port forwarding is and how it works. But then they list a whole bunch of routers and give you examples of how to enable and set up port forwarding on so many different routers. If you're different routers even call it by different names, so there's also port triggering. So there's a lot of different standards and different nuances to this. If you're really familiar with the concept and you've set up a few of them, you probably don't need to read directions for it. You can probably figure out no matter what router is out there. And some of them even you end up having to give them some command line work. But most routers, it's a graphical user interface. And if you use port forwarding, there's so many things that you can remote control and use around a radio station or whatever facility that you're working at. For example, I've got a radio station in American Samoa, and we need to be able from the mainland here. We need to be able to control a number of different computers remotely. And sure, we can use PC Anywhere or VNC. As a matter of fact, we do use PC Anywhere. But we want to be able to access each computer individually. And we can do that by using port forwarding. And then we program the computer itself, open its firewall with a given port. And we always use the non-standard ports. We never use the standard port that would pop up for, say, VNC or for PC Anywhere. We pick a very non-standard port that's not as likely to be hit by a script kiddie who's checking all the ports. And that way we can get into each individual PC quite easily, can get into other types of equipment too if it's some kind of other remote control gear. You can also use port forwarding to do things like increase the reliability of applications like Skype or a Vonage box, real-time kind of boxes that you want to be able to access from the outside world, or you want them to have a clear path, a known path through the router where it doesn't have to assign a port on the fly that may change or may conflict with something else that was already assigned to that port. For example, here at the Tort Studios in Nashville, Tennessee, I've got port forwarding set up for a Telos Zephyr IP, so it essentially has a clear view to the internet, even though it doesn't have a public IP address itself. It's behind my NAT router, but it has a port assigned to it, an odd numbered port. Same thing for some SIP telephones I have here, and same thing for the Skype session that we're doing right now. Instead of letting Skype negotiate that port, we go ahead and forward a range of ports to the very Mac that I'm using right now for that, and it increases that. So if you don't know about port forwarding, I encourage you to learn about it. It's really, really handy to get things done and to allow you to work remotely. So that's my tip of the week. Mr. Ray, do you have something for us?
No, because I wasn't prepared, and I was so busy listening to your explanation there. My mind wandered.
Have something for us next week. Let's see if I strike out with everybody. If I do, it's the teacher's fault, really. Hey, Mr. Tobin, you got something for us?
Yes, I do. I recently purchased a Fluke Networks IntelliProbe and IntelliTone kit, the IntelliTone 200, I think it's called. And it's really handy for checking out Ethernet cables, wire mapping, and sniffing out cables if you run them and you figure out where they are. It's got the tone built in. It's designed to read its own tone, so it doesn't pick up on any of those turkey tones you get from the Ames manufactured dual tone test sets you get for phone stuff. And it also has the ability to give you continuity testing. And you can also plug it into a RJ11 or put it across a 66 block and check your polarity of your dial tone, if there's battery on the wire, of course. So it's a very handy little kit. It's two components. It sells for under, I think, $200. And I just picked one up this week for the guys at the shop so we can do some quick troubleshooting. We've got so much cabling everywhere with the 68 racks of equipment. It's been great. It comes with banana plugs and alligator clips. You just clip it onto a dial tone line, check it, run it, go. I mean, it's everything. Ethernet, you plug in, you can check out your cables and carry it in small blocks. So, case. It's
And this is a Fluke. What's the model again?
I'm sorry. It's a Fluke Networks IntelliTone 200 toner and probe kits. You just do a search for Fluke Networks IntelliTone. It'll probably come up with all of them. I figure what the 100 does less, but the 200 is nice. It's, I think, just under $200 at Newark and a few other places. It really works out nice. It's much better than I thought. Pleasantly surprised.
Let's surprise Mr. Tarr. You got something for us this week?
I do. Website, historicaerials.com. And it's a great site. In fact, I'm gonna bring up here, make sure I got the website address. Yes. Historic Aerials, AERIALS. And what it is it's sort of like Google Earth, except for the way that it works is it has old map data, in areas that it has it going back to the 1940s, aerial views of different places. So for example, for my town, which, by the way, Kirk, is Muckwanago, Wisconsin.
Isn't that what I said?
You can pull up aerial photos from, I believe, 1942, as early as that, like 1942, 1964, 1970. And one of the neat things that they have there is they have some tours, things like old baseball stadiums, old drive-in theaters. And you could literally spend hours just poking around. And on that site where you see the dark green blocks, those are areas where they have real old imaging, again, as early as the 40s, and just some really neat shots. And you can spend hours just looking up old tower sites and, old highways and things like that.
Huh. Absolutely amazing. That's cool. I'll check that out. We'll put that in the show notes, too. Hey, guys, we are out of time, and I want to thank you all for being here. We're going to have another great show next week. If you want to download this show from the iTunes store, the iTunes, the free air, the podcast, you certainly can. You can subscribe to it right there in iTunes and have it downloaded automatically. On our website, thisweekinradiotech.com. There's an RSS feed button. I think it works. Seems to. And there's also the ability to download the show from right there as well. You can also find the show Twirt on Facebook. You're welcome to friend it, like it, whatever it lets you do. And you can even play the show from right there on the on its Facebook page. You can follow us. Follow me on Twitter. It's at K Harnack, KHARNACK. Plus, you can find out about all of our co-hosts and past shows. You can catch up on things if you like to, all at the website at thisweekinradiotech.com. We got to go. Thanks for joining us. We sure appreciate you and hope you'll join us again next week for This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
This Week in Radio Tech is sponsored by Axia Audio. With over 2,000 consoles on air around the world, Axia is the leader in IP audio. And now it's easiest, too. Check them out at axiaaudio.com.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another twirt has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise. Yes.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes Store.
Soliciting is strictly encouraged.
If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here.
Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LaPay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.